The time now is approximately 6:30, and you are listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz on the 101.3 FM dial or at freakradio.org if you're streaming on your smartphone or your computer. We will be together for about an hour, and we'll be discussing and giving you some health information. But first, we'll play a little music, and I believe we have... We have some information about the cholesterol and eggs. Okay, you might want to listen to.
Heavy hitters. David Spence is the director of the Stroke Prevention and Atherosclerosis Research Center. David Jenkins, the guy who invented the glycemic index, and Dr. Devin Yon, the director of the Hyperlipidemia and Atherosclerosis Research Group at the Montreal Institute for Clinical Research. The last time Dr. Spence spoke up publicly against eggs, his house got its cholesterol raised too. But the reason they felt the need to set the record straight is that recent media reports reflect the remarkable effectiveness of the sustained propaganda campaign of the egg producers' lobby to downplay the risks of cholesterol. The fundamental flaw of the studies the egg industry uses to muddy the waters on the issue is that they tend to only measure fasting cholesterol levels, which just reflects what's happening to your arteries for the last few hours of the night, not after you've eaten breakfast. Not only do eggs make your bad cholesterol go up, but for hours after you eat, dietary cholesterol increases the susceptibility of LDL, bad cholesterol, to oxidation, vascular inflammation, oxidative stress, and postprandial hyperlipidemia, and potentiates the harmful effects of saturated fat, impairs endothelial function, and increases cardiovascular events, meaning heart attacks. Dietary cholesterol may only increase our fasting cholesterol levels 10%, but it may increase the susceptibility of our bad cholesterol to oxidize by 37-39%, and that's what triggers much of the arterial inflammation that leads to the artery clogging plaque development. So maybe an omelet might not be good, but how much dietary cholesterol is in just like one egg? A single egg yolk contains approximately 215 milligrams to 275 milligrams of cholesterol, depending on the size. The yolk of a large egg provides more than the 210 milligrams of cholesterol in a Hardee's Monster Thick Burger, which contains 2/3 of a pound of beef, 3 slices of cheese, and 4 strips of bacon. The media storm that followed compared an egg to the fast food monstrosity du jour, the KFC Double Down, where even the bun is made out of meat. What came worst, the chicken or the egg? A single egg yolk thus exceeds the recommended daily intake of cholesterol. So you could eat just like celery the whole rest of the day, and you could still be over the limit. Despite the harassment he's gotten, he remains unperturbed. He said egg yolks shouldn't be regarded as an item that's suitable for human diets, for anyone at risk of vascular disease, and you name me one person that isn't.
So there you have some of the scientific views on eggs. There are pretty intelligent people out there in the health field, and they're recommending you eat, some of them themselves eat 10 and 20 eggs a day. So you'll find controversy out there, but the science behind it shows that, as you heard some of it there, an egg has, more cholesterol than some of these huge meat burgers you buy in stores. Now, there's cholesterol is not the only cause of the heart problems and the dying from heart disease. There's also the question of inflammation. And recent years, it's been shown that inflammation actually comes first, and then after the inflammation comes the cholesterol being laid down in the arteries and the closure of the arteries and the apertures in the arteries. But, you know, if you have a susceptibility to heart arteries closing and other arteries in the body closing, you've got to keep an eye on cholesterol as well. So that's one of the reasons I played that for you. My name is Dr. Mike. I'm an MD and a naturopath and a teacher of meditation for a good number of years. And this program is geared to giving you information that will help your health and wellness, and also to help you restore your health if you actually have fallen sick. And the long-term purpose of this program is to make you more independent of the drug companies, which control everything. They control the hearts and minds of the doctors in the white coats. They control the medical curriculum. The doctors don't know anything about health except drugs. They're so conditioned. And it's a very, very narrow viewpoint, and it's not a good healing art. Also, the medical literature, the journals, are now more and more being controlled by the drug companies. We have a doctor of 25 years who was the editor of the New England Journal of Medicine coming out and explaining to us how the drug companies control what goes in the medical journals. So there's immense amount of control there. And unless you have some knowledge of health, you're going to be completely dependent on these drug companies and their control on doctors as you get older. So be warned, if you want to be free, you know, same thing with priests and religion. If you want to be free from the control of the priests and religion, you got to know the truth yourself. You got to be able to stand on your own two feet and know the truth yourself. So you don't not dependent emotionally on anybody outside yourself for this kind of information. The phone number here at the radio is, you can call in at any time if you have any health problems you want to discuss. The number here is 831-427-3772. We do have an email here, but I'm not starting to use that yet. The slogan for this program is, may you gradually switch from a meat-based diet to a whole plant-based diet. The science shows that is the direction of longer life, that is the direction of freedom from disease, and that is the direction of the human body is more comfortable. And the phytonutrients that are gained and the fiber and all these things are gained from plants, not from animal bodies. Okay, if you have a pen and pencil, it'll be good for you to have that out so you can jot down the things that you learn on the show. Unfortunately, I lost one of my computers was stolen over the weekend, so unfortunately, I'm working from one computer, and I don't know if it's starting to skip around or if it's just me. All right, the next one that we have ready here is about cholesterol again.
The number one digestive reason people are hospitalized, though, is because of a gallbladder attack. Every year, more than 1 million Americans are diagnosed with gallstones, and about 700,000 have to get their gallbladder surgically removed. What are gallstones made of? In 80 to 90% of cases, the gallstones are made out of cholesterol. Here's a picture of someone's gallbladder packed with gallstones. All that yellow you see making up the stones is pure crystallized cholesterol that built up in this person's body. If the only source of dietary cholesterol is animal foods, one might expect meat eaters to be at higher risk. Turns out you have to go all the way to Kathmandu to find some good science. Non-vegetarians were found to be at higher risk for gallstones than vegetarians, but not just a little more risk, 9 times the risk, 9-to-1 odds of getting gallstones, non-vegetarians versus vegetarians.
Okay, where you can see cholesterol is also involved in gallstones. We're waiting for the next clip to come up.
No matter where we live, how old we are, what we look like, health researchers have discovered that 90% of having a first heart attack can be attributed to 9 modifiable risk factors. The 9 factors that are threatening our lives include smoking, too much bad cholesterol, high blood pressure, diabetes, abdominal obesity, stress, a lack of daily fruit and vegetable consumption, as well as a lack of daily exercise. But Dr. William Clifford Roberts, executive director of the Baylor Heart and Vascular Institute and longtime editor-in-chief of the American Journal of Cardiology, is convinced that atherosclerosis has a single cause, namely the cholesterol, and that the other so-called atherosclerotic risk factors are only contributory at most. In other words, we could be stressed, overweight, smoking, diabetic, couch potatoes, but if our cholesterol is low enough, there may be just not enough cholesterol in our bloodstream to infiltrate our artery walls and trigger the disease. Thus, the only absolute prerequisite for a fatal or non-fatal atherosclerotic event like a heart attack is an elevated cholesterol level. It was not appreciated until recently that the average blood cholesterol level in the United States, the so-called normal level, was actually abnormal, accelerating the blockages in our arteries and putting a large fraction of the normal population at risk. It's our number one killer. That's cited as one of the reasons the cholesterol controversy lasted for so long, an unwillingness to accept the notion that a very large fraction of our population actually has an unhealthily high cholesterol level. Normal cholesterol levels may be terminal cholesterol levels. The optimal cholesterol level, the optimal bad cholesterol LDL level, is 50 to 70. Accumulating data from multiple lines of evidence consistently demonstrate that that's where a physiologically normal LDL level would be. That appears to be the threshold above which atherosclerosis and heart attacks develop. That's what we start out at birth with, that's what our fellow primates have, that's the level seen in populations free of the heart disease epidemic. But we can also look at all the big randomized controlled cholesterol-lowering trials. This is graphing the progression of atherosclerosis versus LDL cholesterol. More cholesterol, more atherosclerosis. But if you draw a line down through the points, you can estimate that the LDL level at which there is zero progression is down around an LDL cholesterol of 70. You can do the same with studies preventing heart attacks in the first place. Zero coronary heart disease events might be reached down around 55, and those who've already had a heart attack and trying to prevent a second one might need to push their LDL levels even lower. Atherosclerosis is endemic in our population, in part because the average person's LDL cholesterol is up around 130, approximately twice the normal physiologic level. The reason the federal government doesn't recommend everyone shoot for at least even just under 100 is that despite the lower risk accompanying more optimal cholesterol levels, the intensity of clinical intervention required to achieve such levels for everyone in the population would financially overload the healthcare system. Drug usage would rise enormously. But they're assuming drugs are the only way to get our LDL that low. But those eating really plant-based diets may hit the optimal cholesterol target without even trying, just naturally nailing under 70. The reason given by the federal government for not advocating what the science shows is best was that it might frustrate the public, who would have difficulty maintaining a lower level. But maybe the public's greatest frustration would come from not being informed of the optimal diet for health.
Okay, that's some figures that show no normal levels of cholesterol. Like he said, in certain societies, there and in primates, they're down at 50 to 70. We're a long way lower than where we find them in our society, in our own society. Some people are worried that if their cholesterol is very low, they won't have enough cholesterol to make the different hormones in the body and for the brain and different parts of the body, different things, because it's used in a lot of different hormones and maybe even the parts of the brain. But science seems to be showing that 50 to 70 is a good level to be at. Now, some people, their bodies are genetically or whichever, they're kind of sluggish. They're sluggish in getting rid of the cholesterol out of their body. And so they have this inherited type of genetic hyperlipidemia. In other words, they have a tendency for high blood lipids. And I think one of the things that needs to be done in that case is the liver needs to be enhanced. And certain herbs like milk thistle and dandelion and like lipoic acid and other things that help the liver to function properly, that could certainly help. Anyway, it's time to go on to the next clip. Here we go.
Top 5 foods for the brain. They say you are what you eat. While a nutritious and well-balanced diet is of course great for our bodies, there are some foods that are more beneficial and more nutritious than others. We bring you a list of 5 foods proven to enhance the brain's overall health as well as ensure it is functioning properly on a daily basis. Number 5. At 5, berries are good. Blueberries are well known for their role in improving motor skills as well as your overall learning capacity. They are often called the best berry for your brain. Most berries, including blackberries, blueberries, raspberries, and others, are full of antioxidants that are great for boosting the brain. You can help reverse the effects of aging on the brain by eating these berries once a day. Berries are sometimes referred to as superfruits because most of them contain phytin and flavonoid, which are great for improving your memory and allowing you to easily recall past events. Number 4. Looking for a snack that has everything good for the brain in it? Then at number 4, look no further than nuts and seeds. This means peanuts, hazelnuts, cashews, almonds, walnuts, pecans, pumpkin seeds, sunflower seeds, and any other type of nut or seed you can think of are good for your brain. Nuts and seeds are full of omega-3 and omega-6 fatty acids, as well as folate, vitamin E, and vitamin B6. All of these nutrients allow you to think more clearly. They also help you think more positively because omega-3 and omega-6 fatty acids work as natural antidepressants. Some seeds and nuts are also full of thiamine and magnesium, which are great for memory, cognitive function, and brain nourishment. Number 3. Leafy green vegetables such as cabbage, spinach, and others, while not very well liked by children, are excellent for the brain of children and adults, and therefore they wing it in at number 3. They help greatly when it comes time to remember old information and process it like you just learned it yesterday. This is because these foods are often full of vitamin B6, B12, and folate, which are great compounds needed within the brain to break down homocysteine levels, which can lead to forgetfulness and even Alzheimer's disease. These vegetables are often very high in iron content. If there is not enough iron intake, cognitive activity slows down greatly. Number 2. Fish comes in at 2 because eating fish overall is greatly beneficial to your health, especially that of your brain. Fish is full of omega-3, which is a fatty acid known to be highly beneficial to the body in various aspects. Eating one serving of fish a week can highly decrease one's chances of getting Alzheimer's disease. These fatty acids help with brain function because they coat the neurons. Omega-3s coat the neurons with good fat, allowing them to move easily throughout the brain. Omega-3s also provide more oxygen to the brain as well as allows one to retain new information while still remembering old information. The best fish to eat for brain health are salmon, tuna, and herring. Number 1. The yummiest brain food ever and number 1 is chocolate. While eating scores of chocolate bars may make you sick and drinking a lot of hot cocoa in a day just may do the same, the main ingredient in these also delicious foods, cocoa is said to be very nutritious for the brain. Scientists have proven that the antioxidant content found in just 2 or 3 tablespoons of cocoa powder is much stronger than those antioxidants found in other foods such as green tea or red wine. The main antioxidant found in cocoa, known as flavanols, is said to help increase blood flow to the brain. While normal milk chocolate lacks flavanols, you will find plenty of it in dark chocolate.
Okay, that was the 5 best foods to help your brain stay healthy and stay functioning. And I concur with all those different foods that you mentioned. I'd like to make one or two comments, though. If you're going to eat dark chocolate, which is fine, the problem is it has milk in it, and milk decreases the amount of antioxidants that the body is able to obtain. So the best way to take cocoa, which is the bean that the chocolate's made from, the best way is to get the pure powder in the in your health food store. That's the way I take it. It's very good, as you heard her say, for cleaning up your arteries, especially the arteries to your brain and heart. So it's something that I strongly recommend. And also pomegranate juice is pomegranate. The fruits themselves are also scientifically validated to open your arteries, clean your arteries. So if you have any problems like that, as most people have as they get older, clogging up of their arteries, that's arteriosclerosis, it's very good to take at least those two things for that condition. Fish is good, but you got to just be a little careful, especially with tuna, because the big fish in the sea accumulate mercury there as you go up the biological chain to the bigger fish. So it's better to stick to wild salmon, sardines, mackerel maybe. All right, but outside that, all the other information is pretty accurate there. All right, we'll move to the next clip. See if I can decipher what this is. The 5 best foods that that boost your metabolism, right?
And keeping a check on your weight. Number 5. At number 5 is green tea, whose special caffeine content speeds up your heart rate, which in turn leads to a faster metabolism rate. A great way to keep the waistline in check. Number 4. Broccoli is at number 4 because its high calcium and vitamin C content helps in burning calories faster, contributing to your weight loss goals. Number 3. Almonds come in at number 3. Yes, they have a lot of calories, but they also come packed with fatty acids, which increases the metabolic rate of your body. Another weight loss friendly food. Number 2. And number 2 are salmon and tuna that are known for their healthy fats and weight loss benefits. But you need to make sure you're having the right kind of stuff to keep your weight in check. Number 1. And the number 1 spot goes to oatmeal because its fat-soluble fiber makes sure that you stay full for a longer period, thereby contributing to your weight loss goals. But remember not to overload it with sugar.
Okay, I used to know her name. That's a medical doctor, an MD, from I think born in India but living in the United States. When I get her and find her name, I'll let you know what it is. But she mentioned a few things there that enhance your metabolism and thereby help you to lose weight. Oatmeal, of course, is valuable for a lot of things, and it's actually a good breakfast remedy to have. If you're diabetic, I wouldn't eat too much of it. Restrict yourself to a reasonable proportion. But all the other foods she mentions are worth noting. And that's why I say it's good to have a pencil and pen so you can write some of this information down. All right, we're about to move on to the next one. The 10 foods that are slowly killing you. All right, so these are the 10 foods you should pretty much avoid.
Considering a single can of soda contains almost 10...
I'll go back to the beginning again.
Most of us are trying to eat better. But if you think a healthy diet consists of these 10 foods, think again. It's time you discovered the hidden dangers lurking in popular North American foods. Considering a single can of soda contains almost 10 teaspoons of refined sugar, it's little wonder that a soda addiction leads to weight gain, anxiety, and type 2 diabetes. Canned tomato sauce is a hidden source of sugar and high fructose corn syrup, which is why regular consumption raises the risk of obesity, diabetes, coronary artery disease, and dental decay. Nitrates sound like a ticking time bomb in your lunch bag, especially when you consider the amount of sodium and preservatives in sandwich meats that contribute to heart disease and cancer. Artificial sweeteners are low in calories, but that doesn't mean they're safe. Food scientists consider aspartame the most dangerous substance on the planet because it's linked to high blood pressure, type 2 diabetes, and heart disease. Nutritionists give trans fats or saturated fats a big thumbs down. Studies show that a diet high in hydrogenated oils leads to bad cholesterol, heart disease, and stroke. The quickest way to sabotage a fresh salad is by covering it in a bottled salad dressing. Even fat-free and low-fat dressings are jam-packed with sugar, high fructose corn syrup, and artificial coloring. Whole milk products contain a load of saturated fat and an ingredient called bovine growth hormone to boost cow milk production. Sadly, both promote childhood obesity, migraines, and rheumatoid arthritis in people. There's a reason why health officials believe hot dogs should carry cigarette-style warnings. America's favorite ballpark treat is so full of sodium, chemicals, and toxins that regular consumption increases the risk of colorectal cancer. It's estimated that potato chips and French fries cause a few thousand colon, breast, prostate, and bladder cancers each year due to acrylamide, a carcinogen formed during the deep-fried cooking process. White bread, white rice, white pasta, and pretty much every snack food on the market contain enriched wheat flour, which is stripped of nutrients, but leads to weight gain, type 2 diabetes, and cardiovascular disease. To learn more, go to activebead.com to read the full article, or check out some of our related videos.
Okay, and just most of what she's talked about, I agree with. For instance, children who eat 3 hot dogs a week, they have 8 times more chance of getting non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. 8 times, that's quite a high percentage higher. So beware, there's problems with your food. Learn what they are and avoid the ones that give you cancer and other bad things, all right? We go to the next clip now.
Or broth.
This will be a continuation of a talk we had last week by Dr. Michael Greger. And he explains how he makes foods. And if you listen carefully, you'll learn something from how to put together healthy foods.
Looks a little green. My buffalo tempeh strips. Oh, if they make it to the sandwich, I just eat them straight. And then maybe a little of that vegan mayonnaise or some slices of avocado if you're really going fancy. And then there you go, one of my favorite sandwiches. Actually, that's my second favorite sandwich. My favorite sandwich spread is hummus, a Middle Eastern chickpea dip. Even Socrates talked about the wonders of the stuff. Now, you can buy it in the store, but it's kind of expensive, and it really only has 4 ingredients in it. Chickpeas or garbanzo beans, tahini, lemon juice, and garlic. So you can kind of juggle those just to fit you just right. Start out with a can of chickpeas. I just pour the whole thing in, juice and all. Then a quarter cup of tahini, that sesame seed paste, 2 tablespoons of lemon juice, about the juice of 1 lemon, and 1 clove of garlic chopped up. Blend that up,
upstairs to check to see if it's done. And then you taste it. So if it's not garlicky enough, add more garlic. Not lemony enough, add more lemon. Now, see, it has kind of a, it has a kind of a grainy texture. Some people don't mind that. If you want the kind of fluffy, whipped texture that you get when you buy at the store, you can add some oil. You can add some olive oil or some flaxseed oil, and again, kind of whip it up and get that more fluffy texture. And once you have your hummus, then you can, you know, dip veggies or whole grain crackers in it, slather it on a sandwich. You know, sandwiches don't have to be bread. They can be, you know, vegetables stuffed inside of a pita or whole wheat tortillas. What about some other quick lunch ideas? Well, how about a yam or sweet potato? You know, one half of one sweet potato has 100% of your vitamin A for the day in the form of beta carotene. This consumer group called the Center for Science and Public Interest actually ranked dozens of vegetables in terms of their nutritional content, and sweet potatoes shot to a surprise finish at number one. Oh, we better get some of these into our diet. Thankfully, it's totally easy. All we do is we take one, we poke it, throw it in the microwave for 5 minutes and let it cool down for another 5 minutes. You can, you know, cut it in half, drizzle it with a little maple syrup, a dash of cinnamon or something. What I do is I take these, take them right hot out of the microwave and, you know, in cold Boston winters, put them in my pockets as hand warmers, and then, you know, later on in the day, sitting at the bus stop or anything, take it out and just eat it. Tasty, healthy, nutritious, filling. What else? Instant bean burrito, you know, if you got a jar of salsa, you know, that can of organic refried vegetarian beans and some whole wheat tortillas, and you're all set, except for the veggies, right? We always want to tuck some greens in there, right? There's no dish that cannot be made healthier by adding some dark leafy greens, right? Speaking of beans and bean burritos, one can have, you know, veggie franks and beans. You know, you chop up some so your favorite veggie dogs, and in 5 minutes, you have a meal in the microwave, right? Of course, adding some greens, some chopped fresh or frozen spinach. Always got to have your greens at every meal if you possibly can. Mashed potatoes and gravy. Well, there's that wonderful, you know, that chicken-flavored gravy, right? I mean, you could put that stuff on dog turds, make them taste good. Absolutely wonderful. You know, but again, throw some steamed veggies on top. You know, if you have a steamer, you can steam your vegetables. But, you know, actually, if you just steam them in the microwave, it actually retains more nutrients, right? So you throw some spears of broccoli or something in a microwave, put microwave-proof dish, throw a plate on top with a little water at the bottom, put it in your microwave for a few minutes until it's nice, tender, and crisp, and actually retains more nutrients. So you can throw that on to your mashed potatoes or anything else. Or how about spaghetti for lunch? But, well, does it have to be whole wheat spaghetti? Isn't that kind of grainy and gross? Well, you know, actually, I don't like promoting brands, but there actually is this one brand that does seem to do it right. I don't even know how you pronounce it. Bionature, B-I-O-N-A-T-U-R-A-E. But they make this whole wheat pasta that isn't grainy. I mean, it tastes like regular pasta, but again, has so much more phytonutrients in it, right? Then you take this, you know, a jar of sauce, you know, you have some frozen veggies. Again, you know, you don't have to skimp on healthy eating just because you haven't gone shopping. You can have all these things always available for you at all times. Maybe some, you know, the meatballs, a little, you know, the Parmesan on top. All right, before we hit supper, what about healthy snacks? You know, healthy snacks may seem a contradiction in terms, but it really isn't. For example, I mean, what could be more convenient than, you know, fresh fruits or veggies, right? Nature's original fast food, you know, a banana or an orange. I mean, it even comes conveniently packaged in a, you know, biodegradable container, right? Or, you know, grapes, berries, cherries, cherry tomatoes, nature's perfect finger food, right? And don't forget dried fruits, right? A little box of raisins or, you know, dried apricots or figs or prunes. So fresh fruit, dried fruit, even frozen fruit. You can get these wonderful black cherries, these frozen black cherries. My mom actually told me this, showed me, and you can just suck on them better than popsicles. You can take grapes and freeze them and, you know, suck on them and let them melt. I mean, kids just love them, right? Or in terms of veggies, you know, carrot sticks dipped in hummus or broccoli florets in a little, you know, creamy dip like the dressing we made before. Or, you know, that sweet potato for a snack, you know. the secret to having is to have healthy snacks in view and in reach. Right? If you have a bowl of fresh fruit on the table, right, and you're like me, you don't like to see things go bad, then you know you'll go and you'll eat it. You know, the first thing you should see when you open your fridge is pre-washed, pre-cut, you know, veggies in bags, so that you know when you have the munchies, you are just surrounded by healthy, nutritious food. If you're in the mood for kind of crispy, crunchy snacks, then you know, roasted or toasted nuts, sunflower seeds, trail mix, or you know, whole grain pretzels or crackers or matzo or air pop popcorn. You go to the movie theater, and odds are they are popping in saturated fat-laden coconut oil. In fact, a typical large, you know, movie popcorn has 80 grams of fat in it, 50 of which are saturated. That's like a half a cup of lard's worth of saturated fat, right? And that's unbuttered, right? Put on that golden flavor, and you're talking about a cup of lard's worth of saturated fat. Don't let your movie ticket be a one-way ticket to an early grave. Air pop your own and bring it with you. Problem with air pop popcorn is then people, you know, pour, you know, butter on top or something. It's like salads. They take a perfectly wonderful food, but then add, you know, saturated fat and cholesterol-laden dressings on top, right? So my favorite healthy topping for popcorn is nutritional yeast. Nutritional yeast is another nutrition-packed superfood. It is just packed with B vitamins and trace minerals. Nutritional yeast has this kind of nice, pleasant, cheesy taste, which is just great for popcorn. Now, it's pasteurized, so it's inactive yeast, so it's fine for people with yeast intolerance. It's nothing to do with Candida yeast. It's a different family. It is related to brewer's yeast, but without that bitter hops flavor, right? So you get all the nutrition of all the brewer's yeast, but without that nasty, bitter flavor. I prefer Red Star brand's vegetarian support formula nutritional yeast because it's fortified with B12 and can be a convenient way to get your vitamin B12 for the day. You can get this in bulk at a natural food store. Problem is how to get these dried flakes of nutritional yeast to actually stick to your dry air pop popcorn. You know, some people do just, you know, spray their popcorn with like a butter-flavored cooking spray or spritz their popcorn with, you know, soy sauce or water in a spray bottle or something, then put on the yeast or, you know, herbs and spices, garlic powder, chili powder, you know, onion soup mix, you know, whatever you want to put on your popcorn. You know, but I actually just like making my own golden flavor by mixing nutritional yeast in warm water. So basically kind of in a 1-to-1 ratio. So I take a tablespoon of nutritional yeast, a tablespoon of warm water, just mix it up, and then drizzle that over my popcorn, and then put a few more, you know, flakes of yeast on top or some salt. Just fantastic. Now that we just had some salty popcorn, what about healthy beverages? Right? Well, the best thing to drink is water. Yeah, drink lots of water. No, really. A big California study came out involving thousands of people found that those that drank at least 5 glasses of water a day had half the cardiac mortality, right? Half the fatal stroke risk. Wow, right? Again, you want to cut your risk of dying from the number one killer in the United States, all you have to do is drink 5 glasses of water every day. And if that seems kind of boring to you, you know, put in a slice of lemon or lime or, you know, tangerine or something to kind of spruce up the flavor. Green tea is also a good choice. More and more evidence is accumulating that the flavonoids in green tea are maybe particularly beneficial. Flavonoids are these wonderful anti-tumor, anti-inflammatory, anti-aging, antioxidant phytonutrients that seem to be concentrated in the plant that they get green tea from. I encourage everyone to drink 2 cups of green tea every day. In fact, let's add it to our checklist. I don't recommend drinking green tea with food, though. Unfortunately, tea can interfere with iron absorption, so I only recommend drinking green tea between meals. Milk is nature's perfect food for baby cows, a superbly engineered fluid designed to, you know, basically can take a 65-pound calf in a few months turned into a 500-pound cow. So if you need to gain a couple hundred pounds, it's great stuff. But you know, Dr. Benjamin Spock, probably the most esteemed pediatrician of all time, wrote the second best-selling book, second only to the Bible, explicitly does not, in the latest edition, does not recommend giving any milk to children. In fact, to anyone for that matter. Most people in the world can't even digest milk past age 5, which kind of makes sense, right? So most Asian Americans, most African Americans, most Native Americans are lactose intolerant and get gassy, bloated, nauseous, or worse when they drink it. Right? Milk is filled with that artery-clogging saturated fat, these you know, allergenic milk proteins, these milk sugars that are indigestible by most people in the world. You know, herbicides, pesticides, and, well, yes, the pus. The cow's milk has been linked to diabetes, has been linked to asthma, has been linked to arthritis. You know, look, we don't drink dog's milk, pig's milk, horse's milk. I mean, even adult cows don't drink cow's milk, right? They're weaned, right? I mean neither should we. Cow milk is for babies, and, of course, baby cows. But where will we get our calcium? Mm-hmm. And true, the number one source of calcium in the American diet is dairy, but the number one source of artery-clogging saturated fat is also dairy. It's also the number one food allergy, right? And so it all depends on what kind of baggage you want with your calcium, right? And Twinkies have calcium in it, right? But you wouldn't want to eat Twinkies for your calcium, right? You can get your calcium from milk and then get the saturated fat and cholesterol, antibiotics, and pesticides and all that. Or you can get your calcium from dark leafy greens, right? Like kale, bok choy, broccoli. The calcium is actually absorbed better than it is in milk. In fact, those that eat a single serving of dark leafy greens or broccoli every day cut their risk of hip fracture in half. Milk can't say that. In fact, it's even controversial if milk helps bones at all, right? So you can, instead, with your calcium and dark leafy greens, get the fiber and the folate and the iron and the antioxidants all without the pus.
All right, we're going to leave off at this point on that talk. We'll take it up again next week. And just looking at the watch, well, we have about another quarter of an hour, 20 minutes. And things are roaring here. High squealing noise. All right, let's see where we go from here now. I'm just going to queue up here. The next, I think we're going to go back to the clips again. And I'll just have to find what I'm looking for, which I think I just found. All right, so we'll just carry on with the clips. They usually last a few minutes, and then we'll move on to the next one. All right, I've set them up to download automatically. First one is about nuts.
We know increased nut consumption has been associated with a reduced risk of major chronic diseases, including heart disease and diabetes. But do those who eat nuts actually live longer lives? Clinical trials have shown nuts help lower cholesterol and oxidation and improve our arterial function and blood sugar levels, but does all this translate into greater longevity? Researchers at Harvard examined the association between nut consumption and subsequent mortality of over 100,000 people followed for decades. In that time, tens of thousands died, but those that ate nuts every day lived significantly longer. Daily nut consumers had fewer cancer deaths, heart disease deaths, and fewer deaths from respiratory disease. And this was after controlling for other lifestyle factors, so nut consumers lived significantly longer whether they were older or younger, fat or skinny, whether they exercised more or smoked, drank, or ate other foods that may affect mortality. But nuts are so filled with fat, there may be a concern that frequent nut consumption can result in weight gain. However, that's not what they found, and in fact other studies have associated nut consumption with a slimmer waist, less weight gain, lower risk of obesity. If you look at all the studies put together, it's pretty much a wash. Diets enriched with nuts do not seem to affect body weight, body mass index, or waist circumference much at all. Just for a visual, this is one of the most recent such studies in which subjects were told to add to their diets either 0, 70, or 120 pistachios to their daily diet as quite an afternoon snack every day for 3 months, and the results looked like this. You can't even tell which line is which, whether they're eating no nuts or over 100 a day. Hence, it appears the incorporation of nuts, about one or two small handfuls a day, would be advisable to ensure various health benefits without the risk of body weight gain. And what was nice about this review is that there was no apparent ties to the nut industry. How nuts do we have to go? Not much. Just a few servings a week may boost our lifespan and lower cancer rates. But it appears we have to keep it up. In the PREDIMED study, when long-time nut eaters were told to cut down on eating nuts or choose extra virgin olive oil, within 5 years, they apparently lost much of their longevity benefit. Only the group that started out eating nuts and continued to eat at least the same amount of nuts had the significant survival advantage.
Okay, yeah, you nuts are, you want you to eat nuts, if not every day, a couple of times a week, maybe one or two handfuls each time, each day. They have a lot of benefits for your arteries, benefits for your, against cancer, high oxidative levels, and lots of other things. They help nitrous oxide in your arteries to dilate. So good for impotency in men. So nuts should be added to your diet. They're really important to do that. Next one coming
People
up is
low-carb diet.
May
not see a rise in their cholesterol levels. How is that possible? Because weight loss by any means can drop our cholesterol. We could go on an all-Twinkie diet and lower our cholesterol if we were unable to eat the dozen daily Twinkies necessary to maintain our weight. That's why a good cocaine habit can lower cholesterol. Chemotherapy can drop cholesterol like a rock. Tuberculosis can work wonders on one's waistline. Anything that drops our weight can drop our cholesterol, but the goal isn't to fit into a skinnier casket. The reason we care about cardiovascular risk factors like cholesterol is because we care about cardiovascular risk, the health of our arteries. Well, now we have studies that have measured the impact of low-carb diets on arteries directly, and a review of all the best studies done to date found that low-carb diets impair arterial function, as evidenced by a decrease in flow-mediated dilation, meaning low-carb diets effectively cripple people's arteries. And since the meta-analysis was published, another study found the same thing. Dietary pattern characterized by high protein and fat but low carbohydrate associated with poorer peripheral small artery function, again measuring blood flow into people's limbs. Peripheral circulation is great, but what about circulation in the coronary arteries that feed our heart? There's only been one study ever done measuring actual blood flow to the heart muscles of people eating low-carb diets, and this is it. Dr. Richard Fleming, an accomplished nuclear cardiologist, enrolled 26 people into a comprehensive study of the effects of diet on cardiac function using the latest in nuclear imaging technology, so-called SPECT scans, enabling him to actually directly measure the blood flow within the coronary arteries. He then put them all on a healthy vegetarian diet, and a year later the scans were repeated. By that time, however, 10 of the patients had jumped ship onto the low-carb bandwagon. At first, I bet he was upset, but Shirley soon realized he had an unparalleled research opportunity dropped into his lap. Here he had extensive imaging on 10 people following a low-carb diet and 16 following a healthy high-carb diet. What would their hearts look like at the end of the year? We can talk about risk factors all we want, but compared to the veg group, did the coronary heart disease of the patients following the Atkins-like diets improve, worsen, or stay the same? Those sticking to the vegetarian diet showed a reversal of their heart disease as expected. Their partially clogged arteries literally got cleaned out. They had 20% less atherosclerotic plaque in their arteries at the end of the year than at the beginning. What happened to those who abandoned the treatment diet and switched over to the low-carb diet? Their condition significantly worsened, 40 to 50% more artery clogging at the end of the year. Thanks to the kind generosity of Dr. Fleming, we can actually see the changes in blood flow for ourselves. Here are some representative heart scans. The yellow, and particularly red, represent blood flow through the coronary arteries to the heart muscle. This patient went on a plant-based diet and coronary arteries opened right up, increasing blood flow. This person, however, started out with good flow, but after a year on a low-carb diet, significantly clogged down their arterial blood flow. This is the best science to date, demonstrating the threat of low-carb diets, not just measuring risk factors, but actual blood flow in people's hearts on different diets. Of course, the reason we care about cardiac blood flow is we don't want to die, and a meta-analysis was recently published that finally went ahead and measured the ultimate endpoint, death. And low-carb diets were associated with significantly higher risk of all-cause mortality, meaning low-carbers living a significantly shorter lifespan.
Okay, that was about low-carb diets. One example of that is the Atkins diet, but there are other low-carb diets, and it seems that's not the way to go, for most people at least.
In 1903, Thomas Edison predicted that the doctor of the future would give no medicine, but would instead instruct their patient in the care of the human frame, in diet, and in the cause and prevention of disease. 101 years later, the American College of Lifestyle Medicine was born. We still prescribe drugs when necessary, but our emphasis is based on the understanding that the leading causes of disability in the United States and the leading causes of death are caused mostly by lifestyle, particularly what we put in our mouth, food and cigarettes. An impressive number of studies have shown that lifestyle is the root cause of what ails us. The good news, though, is that by changing our lifestyle, we can dramatically improve our health. We have the power. For most leading causes of death, we've long known that our genes account for at most 10-20% of risk, given the fact that rates of killers like heart disease and major cancers differ up to 100-fold among various populations, and that when people migrate from low-risk to high-risk countries, their disease rates almost always change to those of the new environment. For example, at least 70% of strokes and colon cancer are avoidable, over 80% of coronary heart disease, over 90% of type 2 diabetes, avoidable. So maybe it's time we stop blaming our genes and focus on the 70% plus under our control. That may be the real solution to the healthcare crisis. And it doesn't take much. Adhering to just 4 simple healthy lifestyle factors can have a strong impact on the prevention of chronic diseases. Not smoking, not being obese, half-hour exercise a day, and eating healthier, like more fruits, veggies, whole grains, less meat. 4 simple things cut our risk of developing a chronic disease by 78%. 95% of disease risk, out the window. 80% of heart attack risk, gone. Half a stroke risk, a third of cancer risk, simply gone. Think of what that means in terms of the numbers. As it stands now, each year, 1 million Americans experiences their first heart attack or stroke. 1 million get diabetes. 1 million get cancer. If we clean up our act, do we actually get to live longer too? Well, the CDC followed about 8,000 Americans 20 years or older for about 6 years. They found that 3 cardinal lifestyle behaviors exerted an enormous impact on mortality. People who do not smoke, consume a healthy diet, and engage in sufficient physical activity can substantially reduce their risk of early death. And by not smoking, they just meant not currently smoking. By healthy diet, they just meant in the top 40% in terms of complying with the rather wimpy federal dietary guidelines. And physically active meant averaging about 21 minutes a day or more of at least moderate exercise. Those that managed at least 1 of the 3 had a 40% lower risk of dying. Those that hit 2 out of 3 cut their chances of dying more than half. And those that scored all 3 flushed 82% of their chances of dying in those 6 years down the drain. What does that mean in terms of how much longer we get to live? A similar study on health behaviors and survival didn't just take people's word on how healthy they were eating. They measured the level of vitamin C in people's blood as a biomarker for how many plants people were eating. and the drop in mortality risk in those nailing all four healthy behaviors was equivalent to being 14 years younger. It's like turning back the clock 14 years.
That's quite a revelation, the last piece. Knocking off your biological markers by down to 14 years younger by conducting yourself in those three modalities, exercise, food, and not smoking. I think that's pretty enormous. Let's see what's next on the agenda here. It hasn't come up yet. The name of the last one is turning back the clock 14 years. You can do that by following those three different things. Oh, well, we have something here, but I don't see the name. But let's go back to the beginning here, and we'll play it for you.
In 1903, Thomas Edison predicted that the doctor of the future would give no medicine, but would instead instruct their patient in the care of the human frame, in diet, and in the cause.
Yes, we did have that one. So now I've got to, not quite sure where my place is. Low, can I turn back? Oh, I know what happened. I had that clip in twice by mistake. It should have been only in once. But I put it in twice. All right, here we go again.
Physical inactivity has been called the biggest public health problem of the 21st century. Of course, just because someone calls it that doesn't mean it's true. In fact, physical inactivity ranks down at number 5 in terms of risk factors for death, and number 6 in terms of risk factors for disability. Diet is by far our greatest killer, followed by smoking. But still, there is irrefutable evidence of the effectiveness of regular physical activity in the prevention of several chronic diseases, cardiovascular disease, diabetes, cancer, hypertension, obesity, depression, and osteoporosis, as well as premature death, adding an additional 1 or 2 years onto our lifespan, helping to add years to our life, and above all, life to our years. It truly may be survival of the fittest. How much do we need to exercise? In general, the answer is the more the better. Currently, most health and fitness organizations advocate a minimum of 1,000 calories burned of exercise a week, which is like walking an hour a day, 5 days a week. But 7 days a week may be even better in terms of extending one's lifespan. Moderate intensity can be practically defined by the talk-but-not-sing test, where you can still carry on a conversation but would feel breathless if trying to sing. Exercise is so important that not walking an hour a day is considered a high-risk behavior, alongside smoking, excess drinking, and being obese. Having any one of these effectively ages us 3 to 5 years in terms of risk of dying prematurely. Though, interestingly, those that ate green vegetables on a daily basis did not appear to have that same bump in risk. But even if broccoli-eating couch potatoes do live as long as walkers, there are a multitude of ancillary health benefits to physical activity. So much so that doctors are encouraged to prescribe it, to signal to the patient that exercise is medicine, in fact, powerful medicine. Researchers at the London School, Harvard, and Stanford compared exercise to drug interventions and found that exercise often worked just as well as drugs for the treatment of heart disease and stroke, the prevention of diabetes. Of course, there's not a lot of money to fund exercise studies, so one option would be to require drug companies to compare any new drug to exercise. In cases where drug options provide only modest benefit, patients deserve to understand the relative impact that physical activity might have on their condition. We could throw diet into the mix, too. Yes, the FDA could tell drug companies, your new drug beats out placebo, but does it work as well as kale?
Okay, that was some interesting information about exercise. We should examine our life and see how much exercise we can fit into our life. We should do it every day or at least 5 days a week. All right, we'll move on to one more clip, and then we'll have to bring the show to an end today. I was just skipping an ad there. Oh, we have some music now, actually, and that'll bring us towards the end of the show. And this is Andre Bocelli. Amapola is the name of the song.
Será siempre mi alma tuya sola. Yo te quiero, amada niña mía, igual que ama la flor la luz del día. Amapola, lindísima amapola, no seas tan ingrata y amame, amapola,
that was Andrea Bocelli singing Amapola. So that brings us to the end of another episode of Dr. Mike's Health and Wellness. I hope you learned some useful information during this show. It would be really good if you kept a pencil and a book handy so you can write down what you learned so you can review it at another time, because it's easy to forget some of these things. Gradually you'll be able to build up a book of useful information that will keep you directed towards the road to health and well-being. And you, of course, listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz on the 101.3 FM dial. And it's freakradio.org if you're streaming it on your smartphone or your computer. That's Freak Radio, F-R-E-A-K, radio, all one word, .org. And then you press the red oval button on the image of the tower, and you're on to the station. Of course, my programs are every Monday and Tuesday. Monday, I have a program from 6 to 8 every Monday, and that's called The Awakening of the Self. It's to do with spiritual awakening, realizing your full potential. And then the other program is tonight's program, 6:30 to 7:30. It's called Dr. Mike's Health and Wellness. So if you have continuous interest in this program, we'll see you again next week from 6:30 to 7:30. And I should like to put out some information in the form of a request. We here at Free Radio Santa Cruz, our lease is up and they're renovating the building, and so we have to leave at the end of September, actually, and maybe even before that we might have to move the equipment. So we're presently looking for a place to move our radio equipment, just a small room. It can be 100 square feet or more, depending on what's available. Or it could be at the end of your garden. We can place a shed there, and we could operate from there. Or it could be that you have on your property room for an RV that we could operate out of there. And we are offering a $200 reward for anyone who can give us a lead. So to a place where we could have our transmit our radio station, or have our radio station there for a year. So if you know somebody, or if you have a spare room or a garden or whatever, get in touch with us. The way to get in touch is go to FRSC, that stands for Free Radio Santa Cruz, FRSC at freakradio.org. And if you go there, you'll be able to communicate any information that you might help us do that. And if it works out well, you can get a $200 reward. All right, because we are running out of time, and we don't want to see the radio go off the air, because we have helpful information for people. And it'll be good if you can help us stay on the air. All right, I'd like to thank you for listening, and we'll see you again next Monday at 7:30 to 8:30 in the evening. All right, bye for the moment. And if I can find some music here, yeah, we'll go out with some music. This is a song by Jackie Evancho. It's an Irish song called Danny Boy. The clip is still playing, but I know there's a video photograph of some Irish soldiers, I think. Let's see what happens. Maybe the song will start again, yeah. Twenty-one gun salute. It says Jackie Evancho on this, but I haven't heard her singing yet, so I'm not really sure. Oh, there she is coming now.
Service representative will ensure all requirements for